Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 21st issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance on Tuesday visited a newly opened center in Israel for civilian and military cooperation that he called central to keeping the U.S.-backed ceasefire plan for Gaza on track. Vance, who visited with top U.S. envoys, said the fragile ceasefire is going better than I expected. Envoy Steve Witkoff added that we are exceeding where we thought we would be at this time. Vance, Witkoff, and others are in Israel to shore up the ceasefire following a burst of deadly violence and questions over the plan for long-term peace. Vance was meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other officials and is expected to stay in the region until Thursday. Jared Kushner, President Donald Trump's son-in-law and one of the architects of the ceasefire agreement, is also in Israel. Also on Tuesday, Hamas said it has recovered the remains of two more hostages and planned to hand them over Tuesday evening. Vance urged a little bit of patience amid growing Israeli frustration with Hamas's pace of the returns. Some of the hostages are buried under thousands of pounds of rubble. Some of the hostages, nobody even knows where they are, Vance said. It's just a reason to counsel in favor of a little bit of patience. He added that a lot of this work is very hard as he faced questions over next steps, and he urged flexibility. The ceasefire took effect on October 10th. While it has been tested by Sunday's fighting and mutual accusations of violations, both Israel and Hamas have said they are committed to the deal. Trump has made clear he wants it to succeed. Pressure for the ceasefire's second phase. The head of Egypt's intelligence agency, Major General Hassan Rashad, traveled to Israel on Tuesday to meet with Netanyahu, Witkoff, and others over the ceasefire's implementation, according to Netanyahu's office. The meetings highlight the urgency of launching negotiations for the second phase of the U.S. plan, which must address issues such as the disarmament of Hamas and the governance of post-war Gaza. Hamas negotiators reiterated that the group is committed to ensuring the war ends once and for all. From the day we signed the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement, we were determined and committed to seeing it through to the end, Hamas chief negotiator Khalil al-Hayya, who is in Cairo, told Egypt's Al-Kahira News Television late Monday. Israel identifies another body of a hostage. Israel confirmed that Palestinian militants had released the body of Tal Hamai, who was killed in the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attack that ignited the war. He was abducted from kibbutz near Yitzhak. The 42-year-old was part of its emergency response team and had four children, including one born after the attack. Under the terms of the ceasefire, Israel is waiting for Hamas to turn over the remains of 15 hostages. 13 others have been turned over. Under the deal, Israel is releasing 15 Palestinian bodies for the remains of each dead hostage, according to Gaza's health ministry, part of the Hamas-run government. It said Israel had transferred another 15 on Tuesday, for a total of 165 since earlier this month. Aid into Gaza increases while prices rise. International organizations said they were scaling up humanitarian aid entering Gaza, while Hamas-led security forces launched a crackdown against what it called price gouging by private merchants. The World Food Program said it had sent more than 530 trucks into Gaza in the past 10 days, enough to feed nearly 500,000 people for 2 weeks. That's still well under the 500 to 600 that entered daily before the war. The WFP also said it had reinstated 26 distribution points and hopes to scale up to its previous 145 points across Gaza as soon as possible. Residents said prices for essential goods soared on Sunday after militants killed two Israeli soldiers, and Israel responded with strikes that killed dozens of Palestinians. Israel also threatened to halt humanitarian aid. At a market in the central city of Deir al-Bala, a 55-pound package of flour was selling for more than $70 on Sunday, up from about $12 shortly after the ceasefire. By Tuesday, the price was around $30. Mohammed al-Fakawi, a Kanyanis resident, accused merchants of taking advantage of the perilous security situation. "They are exploiting us," he said. On Monday, Hamas said its security forces raided shops across Gaza, closing at least 10 shops and warehouses, and forced merchants to lower prices. Hamas also has imposed more order, allowing aid trucks to move safely and halting looting of deliveries. Nahed Shehaber, head of Gaza's private truckers union, said there was no stealing aid since the ceasefire started. But other significant challenges remain as Gaza's financial system is in tatters. With nearly every bank branch and ATM inoperable, people pay exorbitant commissions to a network of cash brokers to get money for daily expenses. On Tuesday, dozens of people in Deir al-Bala spent hours in line at the Bank of Palestine, hoping to access their money but were turned away. Without having the bank open, and without money, it does not matter what the prices in the market, that the prices in the market have dropped, said Camelia Al-Hahez. Gaza doctors say bodies returned with signs of torture. A senior health official in Gaza said some bodies of Palestinians returned by Israel bore evidence of torture and called for a United Nations-launched investigation. So far, only 32 of the bodies have been identified, according to Gaza's health ministry. Dr. Munir al-Borsh, the ministry's general director, said on social media late Monday that some had evidence of being bound with ropes and metal shackles, blindfolds, deep wounds, abrasions, burns, and crushed limbs. It was not immediately clear if any of the bodies had been prisoners. They are returned without identifications or details on how they died. The bodies could include Palestinian detainees who died in Israeli custody or bodies taken out of Gaza by Israeli troops during the war. The Israeli Prison Service denied that prisoners had been mistreated, saying it had followed legal procedures and provided medical care and adequate living conditions. Israeli hostages returned from Gaza have also reported metal shackles and harsh conditions, including frequent beatings and starvation. In the initial 2023 attack in Israel, Hamas-led militants killed around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and abducted 251 people as hostages. The Israel-Hamas war has killed more than 68,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry, which does not distinguish between civilians and combatants in its count. The ministry maintains detailed casualty records that are seen as generally reliable by UN agencies and independent experts. Israel has disputed them without providing its own toll. Thousands more people are missing, according to the Red Cross. How AP tracked and analyzed anti-science legislation in U.S. state houses. To track and analyze the spread of anti-science legislation, the Associated Press examined more than 1,000 bills that had been introduced in states across the nation. Reporters identified the bills using the bill tracking software, Plural, and a database maintained by the National Conference of State Legislatures. AP focused on bills related to vaccines, fluoride, and raw, unpasteurized milk, and analyzed each bill for whether it undermined science-based protections for human health. Reporters also examined national advocacy groups connected to U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., capturing bills they supported or opposed and any reasoning they provided for doing so. Only bills that had legislative action in 2025 were included. AP did not include overarching budget bills or broad bills on insurance coverage. While most of the bills AP found sought to change the law directly, AP also included resolutions, study bills, and proposed constitutional amendments that would put the question to voters. When a bill included anti-science language that was later changed, AP included it in its count of anti-science bills that had been introduced. If the anti-science language was removed before it passed, AP did not include it in its count of adopted bills. Among the bills AP classified as anti-vaccine were those that attempt to make it easier to get a vaccine exemption, place additional regulatory burdens, restrictions, or red tape around vaccine programs, entities that require vaccines or health services such as blood banks, make it harder to get a vaccine or keep vaccination rates high enough to protect against disease in the community, ban certain types of vaccines, increase liability related to vaccines, erode or prohibit vaccine requirements and mandates, give unvaccinated people protection against discrimination or special rights, undermine vaccines or vaccine infrastructure. Among other bills AP classified as anti-science were those that attempt to make raw milk easier to buy, sell, and consume, ban fluoride in drinking water, loosen requirements to fluoridate, place additional regulatory burdens or red tape on fluoridation, or make it harder to get fluoride. Put decisions on fluoridation in the hands of voters rather than public officials. Mahmoud Khalil appears in appeals court as Trump administration continues efforts to deport him. Mahmoud Khalil appeared Tuesday in a federal appeals court in Philadelphia as he continues to challenge a deportation case brought by President Donald Trump's administration over his pro-Palestinian activism at Columbia University. The hearing before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals came as the government seeks to overturn a lower court order granting Khalil's June release from a Louisiana immigration jail. Khalil's attorneys have asked the three-judge panel to affirm the district court's ruling, which prevents federal authorities from detaining him again and beginning the deportation process. Drew Inson, an attorney for the government, countered that the lower court judge overstepped his authority and that the case should be left to the immigration judge in Louisiana. All of this is being conducted in an improper form, Inson said, so that should be a full stop. An immigration judge last month ruled that Khalil could be deported, though the case is now under review by a separate appeal board. Khalil, who is a legal U.S. resident, married to an American citizen, has vowed to continue advocating for Palestinians as his case plays out. He was recently permitted by a magistrate judge to travel across the country for rallies and other events. They want to make an example of me to intimidate those speaking out for Palestine across the country, Khalil said in a statement following the hearing. I'm stating unequivocally, I will continue my legal fight in federal courts for my rights and for everyone's right to free speech. Khalil was the first protester arrested in the Trump administration's sprawling effort to deport student activists, academics, and others who joined pro-Palestinian protests, which the government has equated with anti-Semitism. Khalil has repeatedly rejected allegations of anti-Semitism. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Senate Republicans gathering at White House as shutdown effects worsen. In this fourth week of the government shutdown, Senate Republicans are gathering at White House, not for urgent talks on how to end it, but for a display of unity with President Donald Trump as they refuse to negotiate on any Democratic demands. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer called it a pep rally and said it's shameful that House Speaker Mike Johnson has kept the House out of town during the shutdown. Schumer says his side wants to end the shutdown and fix the health care premium crisis that looms over 20 million hardworking Americans. Kushner says Israel and Hamas are transitioning to peace. Both sides are transitioning from 2 years of very intense warfare to now a peacetime posture, Kushner said during a press conference with Vance. Kushner acknowledged the violence in Gaza that has tested the U.S.-brokered ceasefire, but downplayed it. A lot of people are getting a little hysterical about different incursions one way or the other, he said. The U.S. president's top advisors to the Middle East met with 10 of the released hostages and their families Tuesday. It was really an emotional moment, Witkoff said. Many of them were emotional and grateful to Trump for his work in securing the ceasefire and release of hostages, he added. I didn't see any victims in that room, Witkoff said. I saw very strong people. The U.S. Vice President urges patience with the slow return of hostage remains. J.D. Vance visited a newly opened civilian military cooperation center in Israel that the U.S. says is central to keeping Trump's Gaza peace plan on track, and said the fragile ceasefire is going better than I expected. Vance also tried to downplay that his visit was meant to be some sort of urgent play to keep the ceasefire agreement in place. My visit had nothing to do with the events of the past 48 hours, said Vance, who was on his first visit as vice president to Israel, and only his second ever to the country. Vance was expected to meet with families of hostages whose remains are still in Gaza and some of the living hostages released last week. He urged a little bit of patience amid growing Israeli frustration with Hamas's slow pace of return of remains of hostages. Some of these hostages are buried under thousands of pounds of rubble. Some of the hostages, nobody even knows where they are, Vance said. It's just a reason to counsel in favor of a little bit of patience. Inflatable costumes deflate tensions at anti-Trump rallies. Protesters have taken to wearing oversized inflatable costumes to deflate tensions and draw attention at rallies against Trump administration's policies. Crowds across the U.S. and abroad rallied Saturday during No Kings demonstrations against what they call a slide into authoritarianism. While Republicans dismissed them as hate America rallies, many had a festive red, white, and blue feel. The trend began in Portland, Oregon, when a protester showed up in inflatable frog costume. Now crowds there, gathering daily and nightly outside an immigration facility, have embraced the absurd, adding unicorn, axolotl, dinosaur, and banana costumes. Republican senators praised Trump's COVID-19 vaccine push as administration sows doubt in vaccines. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican, Louisiana, who chairs the Senate Health Committee, and the Senate's number two Republican, John Barrasso, Republican, Wyoming, on Tuesday introduced a resolution nominating Trump for next year's Nobel Peace Prize for his work on Operation Warp Speed. Cassidy said the project that accelerated vaccine development with pharmaceutical companies during Trump's first term not only saved millions of lives, but brought the American economy back to life. The praise highlights a tension between some Republicans' support for vaccines and the Trump administration's erosion of trust in the shots. Trump recently falsely suggested a link between vaccines and autism, and Health Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. has taken steps to sow doubt in immunizations, including changing COVID-19 vaccine recommendations and firing a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Vaccine Advisory Committee. Who benefits from the Make America Healthy Again anti-science push? Powerful anti-vaccine advocates and people selling potentially harmful goods such as raw milk are profiting from the push to write anti-science policies into law across the United States. They portray the Make America Healthy Again movement as grassroots, but it's fueled by a web of well-funded national groups led by people who've profited, financially and otherwise, from sowing distrust of medicine and science. The Associated Press found state legislation that includes language in the text or public testimony that explicitly spells out that a reason to change the law is to make money or increase sales for dairy farmers. AP investigation. Wave of anti-science bills pushed by Kennedy allies hit state houses. More than 420 anti-science bills attacking long-standing public health protections, vaccine, milk safety, and fluoride have been introduced in state houses across the U.S. this year. It's part of an organized, politically savvy campaign to enshrine a conspiracy theory-driven agenda into law. An Associated Press investigation found that the wave of legislation has cropped up in most states, pushed by people with close ties to Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Around 30 have been enacted or adopted. The effort would strip away protections that have been built over a century and are integral to American lives and society. Ukraine and European leaders accuse Putin of stalling peace efforts. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders accused Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday of stalling for time amid diplomatic efforts to end his invasion of Ukraine. Their statements oppose any move to make Kyiv surrender land captured by Russian forces in return for peace, as Trump has on occasion suggested. Eight European leaders, as well as senior European Union officials, said in a joint statement they intend to go ahead with plans to use Moscow's billions of dollars or euros of frozen assets abroad to help Kiev win the war, despite some misgivings about the legality and consequences of such a step. They also expressed support for Trump's peace efforts ahead of a meeting with Putin in Budapest, Hungary. No date has been set for the Budapest summit, and Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov indicated Tuesday there's no sense of urgency. Preparation is needed, serious preparation, he told reporters. Trump says he's giving Mideast peace a chance. Trump said in a social media post that he's not ready to give a green light to U.S. allies who have explicitly and strongly, with great enthusiasm, offered to go into Gaza and straighten out Hamas if the militant group continues to act badly. The Republican president said he told these countries and Israel, not yet, because there is still hope that Hamas will do what is right. If they don't, Trump said, an end to Hamas will be fast, furious, and brutal. Trump commented while Vice President J.D. Vance is visiting Israel to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and others to help shore up the fragile U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement with Hamas. The president also thanked Indonesia for helping out with the Middle East. Thune prediction spells trouble for Trump nominee. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says he hopes the White House will withdraw the nomination of Paul Ingrassia, Trump's pick to lead the Office of Special Counsel. The growing opposition to Ingrassia comes after a political report on a text chat showed him saying the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday should be tossed into the seventh circle of hell. Ingrassia also described himself in the chat as having a Nazi streak at times. He's not going to pass, Thune told reporters. Another Republican, Senator Rick Scott, Republican Florida, who serves on the committee with jurisdiction over the nomination, said he doesn't support Ingrassia's confirmation either. A committee hearing to consider Ingrassia's nomination is scheduled for Thursday. Obama to join New Jersey and Virginia governor candidates. Former President Barack Obama will campaign alongside Democrats Abigail Spanberger and Mickey Schrill as they run for governor in Virginia and New Jersey. Their campaigns announced Tuesday that he'll join them on November 1st in rallies in Norfolk, Virginia and Newark, New Jersey. Election day is November 4th in both races. Spanberger, who formerly served in the CIA and Congress, is up against Marine veteran and Republican Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earle Sears in the Virginia governor's race. Cheryl, a congresswoman, former federal prosecutor and U.S. Navy fighter pilot, faces Republican former Assembly member Jack Ciattarelli. Trump endorsed Ciattarelli and said Earl Sears is very good. Most Americans worry about health care costs, AP NORC poll. Most U.S. adults are worried about health care becoming more expensive, according to a new AP NORC poll, as they make decisions about next year's health coverage, and a government shutdown keeps future health costs in limbo for millions. About 6 in 10 Americans are extremely or very concerned about their health costs going up in the next year, the survey from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research finds, a worry that extends across age groups and includes people with and without health insurance. Many Americans have other health care anxieties too. About 4 in 10 Americans are extremely or very concerned about not being able to pay for health care or medications they need, not being able to access health care when they need it, or losing or not having health insurance. Missed paychecks and programs running out of money. The effects of the shutdown are worsening. Federal workers are set to miss additional paychecks amid total uncertainty about eventually getting paid. Government services like the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for women, infants, and children, known as WIC, and Head Start preschool programs that serve needy families face funding cutoffs. The National Nuclear Security Administration is furloughing 1,400 federal workers. The Federal Aviation Administration has reported air controller shortages and flight delays across the United States. Still, there has been little urgency in Washington, as each side believes other will eventually cave. What about Trump? Tuesday's White House meeting will be a chance for Republican senators to engage with the president on the shutdown, after he has been more involved in foreign policy and other issues. The president last week dismissed Democratic demands as crazy, adding, "We're just not going to do it." North Dakota Senator John Hoeven said that Republican senators will talk strategy with the president at Tuesday's lunch. "He'll give us his ideas and we'll talk about ours," Hoeven said. "Anything we can do to try to get Democrats to join us and pass the Republican bill to reopen the government," Hoeven said. Democrats say they believe Trump has to be more involved for the government to reopen. "He needs to get off the sidelines, get off the golf course," said House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries. "We know that House and Senate Republicans don't do anything without getting permission from their boss, Donald J. Trump." Belize signs Safe Third Country Agreement, aiding Trump's immigration crackdown. Details of the Safe Third Country Agreement Belize announced with the United States on Monday aren't immediately clear, even to the Belize Senate, which must ratify the deal before it can take effect. It comes as the Trump administration pressures countries in Latin America and Africa to help him carry out his immigration crackdown. The deal appears to be similar to Paraguay's Safe Third Country Agreement, in which asylum seekers currently in the U.S. could be sent there to pursue protections. A State Department post on X called it an important milestone in ending illegal immigration, shutting down abuse of our nation's asylum system, and reinforcing our shared commitment to tackling challenges in our hemisphere together. Belize opposition leader Tracy Tagar Panton wrote on social media that the deal could reshape Belize's immigration and asylum systems, impose new financial burdens on taxpayers, and raise serious questions about national sovereignty and security. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Memoir by Prince Andrew's and Epstein's accuser reignites a scandal that long dogged UK royals. The British royal family is once again under intense scrutiny as a memoir by Virginia Guffrey, one of the most outspoken accusers of Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein, hits bookstores Tuesday. Nobody's Girl is being published posthumously 6 months after Guffrey died by suicide in April. Guffrey had for years accused Andrew of sexually abusing her on multiple occasions when she was under 18 years old and a victim of sexual trafficking by convicted sex offender Epstein and his former girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. While her book didn't break new ground, it has thrown fuel on a series of new accusations against Andrew, who is trying to control the damage to the monarchy from the long-running scandal over his friendship with Epstein. The 65-year-old prince said last week that he will stop using his titles, including Duke of York, but reiterated that he vigorously denies Guffrey's claims. In her book, which leapt to number one on Amazon's bestseller list on Monday before its publication, Guffrey recounts details of how she first met Andrew in March 2001 and says the royal staff tried to hire internet trolls to hassle her when she sued him years later. Accounts of three interactions with Andrew. Guffrey long alleged that she was recruited at age 16 by Epstein and Maxwell, who introduced her to Andrew in London in March 2001 when she was 17. She said she was forced to have sex with the royal on three separate occasions. She wrote that on the day she first met Andrew, Maxwell woke her up and told her it was going to be a special day and that just like Cinderella, she will meet a handsome prince. She said when they met, the prince told her that my daughters are just a little younger than you. She said Maxwell instructed her to do for him what you do for Jeffrey, adding, I knew better than to question her orders. She said that Epstein gave her $15,000 soon after for having sex with Andrew. Guffrey wrote that she had sex with the royal a second time at Epstein's house in New York about a month later, and a third time on Epstein's private island in the Caribbean, along with about eight other girls who she said all appeared to be under 18. 2022 lawsuit settlement. Guffrey previously detailed how Epstein, Maxwell, and Andrew allegedly forced her to have sex with the prince against her will in a lawsuit that she filed in New York in 2021. Andrew reached an out-of-court settlement with Guffrey in 2022 for an undisclosed sum. While he didn't admit wrongdoing, Andrew did acknowledge Guffrey's suffering as a victim of sex trafficking and agreed to make a donation to her charity. Of that settlement, Guffrey wrote, after casting doubt on my credibility for so long, Prince Andrew's team had even gone so far as to try to hire internet trolls to hassle me. The Duke of York owed me a meaningful apology as well. We would never get a confession, of course. That's what settlements are designed to avoid, she added. But we were trying for the next best thing, a general acknowledgement of what I'd been through. New allegations. Andrew, the second son of the late Queen Elizabeth II, had already stepped down from all of his public duties and charity roles in 2019 after an attempt to dispel reports about his friendship with Epstein backfired badly. The prince was widely criticized for the BBC interview in which he offered unbelievable explanations for his continued relationship with the disgraced financier. He also denied that he had ever had sexual contact with Guffrey, that he had no recollection of meeting her, and absolutely no memory of a now infamous photograph showing him with his arm around her waist in 2001. Andrew also said in the same interview that he had cut off contact with Epstein in December 2010. Last week, British newspapers published an email that purportedly showed that the royal had remained in contact with Epstein longer than he had admitted. In the note, reportedly from February 28, 2011, Andrew said they were in this together and would have to rise above it. Separately, London's Metropolitan Police Force said that it was looking into a report in the mail on Sunday that Andrew in 2011 asked one of his police bodyguards to find out if Giuffre had a criminal record. Buckingham Palace and the UK government are under pressure to formally strip Andrew of his dukedom and princely title and kick him out of the 30-room mansion near Windsor Castle where he lives. Ghostwriter Amy Wallace, who co-wrote the memoir, said that Andrew also should agree to testify in the U.S. about what he knew of Epstein's crimes. Wallace told the BBC that Giuffre deserves all credit for whatever role she played in forcing Prince Andrew to relinquish a few more of his titles. But she deserves all credit, even more than that, for being brave enough to stand up to say, this isn't right. Chicago, an immense show of force, signals a sharp escalation in White House immigration crackdown. The music begins low and ominous, with the video showing searchlights skimming along a Chicago apartment building and heavily armed immigration agents storming inside. Guns are drawn, unmarked cars fill the streets, agents rappel from a Black Hawk helicopter. But quickly the soundtrack grows more stirring, and the video, edited into a series of dramatic shots and released by the Department of Homeland Security days after the September 30th raid, shows agents leading away shirtless men, their hands zip-tied behind their backs. Authorities said they were targeting the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, although they also said only two of the 27 immigrants arrested were gang members. They gave few details on the arrests. But the apartments of dozens of U.S. citizens were targeted, residents said, and at least a half dozen Americans were held for hours. The immense show of force signaled a sharp escalation in the White House's immigration crackdown and amplified tensions in a city already on edge. To every criminal illegal alien, darkness is no longer your ally, Homeland Security said in a social media post accompanying the video, which racked up more than 6.4 million views. We will find you. But Tony Wilson, a third-floor resident born and raised on Chicago's South Side, sees only horror in what happened. It was like we were under attack, Wilson said days after the raid, speaking through the hole where his doorknob used to be. Agents had used a grinder to cut out the deadbolt, and he still couldn't close the door properly, let alone lock it, so he had barricaded himself inside, blocking the door with furniture. I didn't even hear them knock or nothing, said Wilson, a 58-year-old U.S. citizen on disability. Dreams and decay. The raid was executed in the heart of South Shore, an overwhelmingly Black neighborhood on Lake Michigan, that has long been a tangle of middle-class dreams, urban decay, and gentrification. It's a place where teams of drug dealers troll for customers outside ornate lakeside apartment buildings. It has some of the city's best vegan restaurants, but also takeout places where the catfish fillets are ordered through bulletproof glass. It has well-paid professors from the University of Chicago, but is also where one-third of households scrape by on less than $25,000 a year. The apartment building where the raid occurred has long been troubled. 5 stories tall and built in the 1950s, residents said it was often strewn with garbage. The elevators rarely worked, and crime was a constant worry. Things had grown more chaotic after dozens of Venezuelan migrants arrived in the past few years, residents said. While no residents said they felt threatened by the migrants, many described a rise in noise and hallway trash. Owned by out-of-state investors, the building hasn't passed an inspection in 3 years, with problems ranging from missing smoke detectors to the stench of urine to filthy stairways. Repeated calls to a lead investor in the limited liability company that owns the building, a Wisconsin resident named Trinity Flood, were not returned. Attempts to reach representatives through realtors and lawyers were also unsuccessful. Crime fear spiked in June when a Venezuelan man was shot in the head, execution style, the Department of Homeland Security said in a statement. Another Venezuelan was charged in the death. Days after the raid, the doors to dozens of the building's 130 apartments hung open. Nearly all those apartments had been ransacked. Windows were broken, doors smashed, and clothes and diapers littered the floors. In one apartment, a white tuxedo jacket hung in the closet next to a room knee-deep in broken furniture, piles of clothing, and plastic bags. In another, water dripping from the ceiling puddled next to a refrigerator lying on its side. Some kitchens swarmed with insects. Wilson said a trio of men in body armor had zip-tied his hands and forced him outside with dozens of other people, most Latino. After being held for 2 hours, he was told he could leave. "It was terrible, man," he said. He'd barely left the apartment in days. A city under siege. Chicago, the White House says, is under siege. Gang members and immigrants in the U.S. illegally swarm the city, and crime is rampant, President Donald Trump insists. National Guard soldiers are needed to protect government facilities from raging left-wing protesters. Chicago is the worst and most dangerous city in the world, he posted on Truth Social. The reality is far less dramatic. Violence is rare at protests, though angry confrontations are increasingly common, particularly outside a federal immigration center in suburban Broadview. And while crime is a serious problem, the city's murder rate has dropped by roughly half since the 1990s. Those realities have not stopped the Trump administration. What started in early September with some arrests in Latino neighborhoods, part of a crackdown dubbed Operation Midway Blitz, has surged across Chicago. There are increasing patrols by masked armed agents, detentions of U.S. citizens and immigrants with legal status, a fatal shooting, a protesting pastor shot in the head with a pepper ball outside the Broadview facility, his arms raised in supplication. By early October, authorities said more than 1,000 immigrants had been arrested across the area. The raids have shaken Chicago. We have a rogue, reckless group of heavily armed, masked individuals roaming throughout our city, Mayor Brandon Johnson said after the September 30th raid. The Trump administration is seeking to destabilize our city and promote chaos. To Trump's critics, the crackdown is a calculated effort to stir anger in a city and state run by some of his most outspoken Democratic opponents. Out-of-control protests would reinforce Trump's tough-on-crime image, they say, while embarrassing Johnson and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, seen as a possible Democratic presidential contender. So the South Shore raid, ready-made for social media with its displays of military hardware and agents armed for combat, was seen as wildly out of proportion. This was a crazy-looking military response they put together for their reality show, said Levant Stort, who runs a South Shore sports program to steer young people away from violence. It's not like there are roving bands of Venezuelan teenagers out there. Officials insist it was no reality show. The operation, led by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, was based on months of intelligence gathering, according to a U.S. official who was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. The building's landlord told authorities that Venezuelans in about 30 units were squatters and had threatened other tenants, the official said, adding that the building's size necessitated the show of force. Immigration agencies declined further comment. even before the midway blitz, Trump's election had whipsawed through Chicago's Latino communities. Stewart said Venezuelan children began disappearing from his programs months ago, though it's often unclear if they moved, returned to Venezuela, or are just staying home. I had 35 kids in my program from Venezuela, he said. Now there's none. A wave of migrant newcomers. The raid echoed through South Shore, pinballing through memories of the surge in violence during the 1990s drug wars, as well as economic divides and the sometimes uncomfortable relations between black residents and the wave of more than 50,000 immigrants, most Latino, who began arriving in 2022, often bused from southern border states. Chicago spent more than $300 million on housing and other services for the immigrants, fueling widespread resentment in South Shore and other black neighborhoods where the newcomers were settled. They felt like these new arrivals received better treatment than people who were already part of the community, said Kenneth Phelps, pastor at the Concord Missionary Baptist Church in Woodlawn, a largely black neighborhood. It didn't matter that many migrants were crowded into small apartments and most simply wanted to work. The message to residents, he said, was that the newcomers mattered more than they did. Phelps tried to fight that perception, creating programs to help new arrivals and inviting them to his church, but that stirred more anger, including in his own congregation. I even had people leave the church, he said. In South Shore, it's easy to hear the bitterness, even though the neighborhood's remaining migrants are a nearly invisible presence. They took everyone's jobs, said Rita Lopez, who manages neighborhood apartment buildings and recently stopped by the scene of the raid. The government gave all the money to them and not to the Chicagoans, she said. Changing demographics and generations of suspicion. Over more than a century, South Shore has drawn waves of Irish, Jewish, and then black arrivals for its lakeside location, affordable bungalows, and early 20th century apartment buildings. Each wave viewed the next with suspicion, in many ways mirroring how black South Shore residents saw the migrant influx. Former First Lady Michelle Obama's parents moved to South Shore when it was still mostly white, and she watched it change. A neighborhood that was 96% white in 1950 was 96% black by 1980. We were doing everything we were supposed to do and better, she said in 2019. But when we moved in, white families moved out. But suspicion also came from South Shore's black middle class, which watched nervously as many housing projects began closing in the 1990s, creating an influx of poorer residents. This has always been a complex community, Stewart said of those years. You can live on a block here that's super clean with really nice houses, then go one block away and there's broken glass, trash everywhere, and shootings, he said. It's the weirdest thing, and it's been this way for 30 years. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Iraq keeping a small contingent of U.S. military advisors due to IS threat in Syria. Iraq's prime minister said Monday that a small contingent of U.S. military advisors will remain in the country for now to coordinate with U.S. forces in Syria combating the Islamic State group. Washington and Baghdad agreed last year to wind down an American-led coalition fighting the Islamic State in Iraq by this September, with U.S. forces departing some bases where they have been stationed. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani told a small group of journalists in Baghdad that U.S. military advisors and support personnel are now stationed at the Ain al-Assad Air Base in western Iraq, a base adjacent to the Baghdad airport, and the Al-Harir Air Base in northern Iraq. Al-Sudani noted that the agreement originally stipulated a full pullout of U.S. forces from Ain al-Assad by September, but that developments in Syria since then, requiring maintaining a small unit of between 250 and 350 advisors and security personnel at the base. He said they would work to support counter-ISIS surveillance in coordination with Al-Tanf base in Syria. He added that other U.S. sites are witnessing gradual reductions in personnel and operations. After the fall of former Syrian President Bashar Assad in a lightning rebel offensive in December, fears arose in Iraq of an IS resurgence taking advantage of the ensuing security vacuum, as well as of weapons abandoned by the former Syrian army. Al-Sudani maintained that the extremist group, which seized wide swaths of territory in Iraq and Syria a decade ago, no longer poses a significant threat inside Iraq. Iraq has sought to balance Iraq's relations with the United States and Tehran and to avoid being pulled into regional conflicts, a policy that the Prime Minister said he will continue. "We put Iraq first, and we do not wish to act as a proxy for anyone," he said. "Iraq will not be a battlefield for conflicts." At the same time, Al-Sudani urged the U.S. to return to negotiations with Iran, describing the Trump administration's maximum pressure approach to curtail Iranian influence as counterproductive. "Iran is an important and influential country that must be treated with respect and through direct dialogue," he said. There have been tensions between Baghdad and Washington over the presence of Iran-backed militias in Iraq. The Popular Mobilization Forces, a coalition of militias that formed to fight IS, was formally placed under the control of the Iraqi military in 2016, but in practice still operates with significant autonomy. The Iraqi parliament has been considering legislation that would solidify the relationship between the military and the PMF, drawing objections from Washington. Al-Sudani did not directly address the proposed legislation, but said his government's program includes disarmament and national dialogue to remove any justification for carrying weapons. "We encourage all factions to either integrate into state institutions or engage in political life, which could include becoming political parties and running for election," he said. Iraq is preparing for parliamentary elections next month that will determine where Al-Sudani serves a second term. Armed factions that have transformed into political entities have the constitutional right to participate in those elections, the Prime Minister said. Israel still fires on Lebanon almost a year after a ceasefire. Some predict the same for Gaza. As a tenuous ceasefire took hold in Gaza this month, Israel launched more airstrikes on southern Lebanon, 11 months into a ceasefire there. The bombardment of a construction equipment business killed a Syrian passerby, wounded 7 people, including 2 women, and destroyed millions of dollars worth of bulldozers and excavators. The October 11 strikes would be an anomaly in most countries not at war, but near-daily Israeli attacks have become the new normal in Lebanon, nearly a year after a U.S.-brokered truce halted the latest conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. Some see a likely blueprint for the Gaza ceasefire with ongoing but lower-intensity conflicts. On Sunday, Israel struck Gaza after it said Hamas fired at its troops in the first major test of the U.S.-brokered truce. Mona Yacoubian, director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies think tank, described the Lebanon scenario as a less fire rather than a ceasefire. "Lebanon could well serve as the model for Gaza, essentially giving leeway to Israeli forces to strike whenever they deem a threat without a full resumption of conflict," she said. A ceasefire with no clear enforcement. The latest Israel-Hezbollah conflict began the day after the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led attack on Israel triggered the war in Gaza. The militant group Hezbollah, largely based in southern Lebanon, began firing rockets into Israel in support of Hamas and the Palestinians. Israel responded with airstrikes and shelling. The low-level conflict escalated into full-scale war in September 2024. The ceasefire on November 27, 2024, required Lebanon to stop armed groups from attacking Israel and Israel to halt offensive military actions in Lebanon. It said Israel and Lebanon can act in self-defense without elaborating. Both sides can report alleged violations to a monitoring committee of the U.S., France, Israel, Lebanon, and the UN peacekeeping force known as UNIFIL, but the deal is vague on enforcement. In practice, Israel has largely taken enforcement into its own hands, asserting that its strikes in Lebanon target Hezbollah militants, facilities, and weapons. Israel says it aims to stop the badly weakened group from rebuilding. Lebanese officials say the attacks obstruct its efforts to get Hezbollah to disarm by giving the group a pretext to hold on to its weapons. Lebanon also says Israel's strikes, including the October 11th one, often harm civilians and destroy infrastructure unrelated to Hezbollah. Lebanon's health ministry has reported more than 207 people killed and around 850 wounded by Israeli military actions since the ceasefire. As of October 9th, the UN Human Rights Office had verified that 107 of those killed were civilians or non-combatants, said spokesperson Tamin Al-Kitan. No Israelis have been killed by fire from Lebanon since the ceasefire. From November 27, 2024 to mid-October, UNIFIL detected around 950 projectiles fired from Israel into Lebanon and 100 Israeli airstrikes, spokesperson Candice Erdel said. During the same period, it reported 21 projectiles fired from Lebanon toward Israel. Hezbollah has claimed one attack since the ceasefire. Conflicting narratives. After the October 11th strikes in Saleh, Israel's army said it hit engineering equipment intended for the reconstruction of terrorist infrastructure in southern Lebanon. Lebanese authorities, Hezbollah, and the equipment's owner disputed that. "Everyone in Lebanon, from all different sects, comes to buy from us," owner Ahmad Tabaha told journalists. "What have we done wrong?" Lebanese President Joseph Aoun called the strikes blatant aggression against civilian facilities. Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri accused Israel of seeking to prevent communities' reconstruction. Lebanon complained to the UN Security Council. A few days later, Israel struck a cement factory and a quarry, claiming Hezbollah planned to use it to rebuild its infrastructure. Last month, an Israeli strike hit a motorcycle and a car carrying a family in Bent Shabil. It killed Shadi Sharara, a car salesman, three of his children, including 18-month-old twins, and the motorcyclist, and badly wounded Sharara's wife and oldest daughter. It was among the highest death tolls since the ceasefire, sparking particular outrage because of the children. "My brother was a civilian, and his children and wife are civilians, and they have nothing to do with politics," said sister Mina Sharara. Israel's military said it was targeting a Hezbollah militant whom it did not name but acknowledged that civilians were killed. Even when the target is a known Hezbollah member, the military necessity can be disputed. Earlier this month, an Israeli drone strike killed a Hezbollah member who was blinded last year in Israel's exploding pagers attack, along with his wife. Israel's army said Hassan Atwi was a key official in Hezbollah's aerial defense unit. Hezbollah officials said he had played no military role since losing his eyesight. The end of mutual deterrence. Hezbollah was formed in 1982 with Iranian backing to fight Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon at the time. Israeli forces withdrew in 2000, and Hezbollah grew into one of the region's most powerful non-state armed groups. In 2006, Hezbollah and Israel fought a month-long war that ended in a draw. For the next 17 years, there was a tense calm that was largely due to mutual deterrence, said Nicholas Blanford, a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Middle East program. Strikes in Lebanon were generally understood to be off-limits. Both sides wanted to avoid another damaging war. Now that equation has changed. Though Blanford said Hezbollah could still deliver blows to Israel, the group's deterrence has been shattered by the recent war, he said. In an interview with the Associated Press last month, Hezbollah political official Mohammed Naish said the prospect of coexisting with daily Israeli attacks is not acceptable. But the group has largely limited itself to calling on Lebanon's government to pressure Israel with what Naish called its political, diplomatic, or other capabilities. He added, if things develop further, then the resistance leadership is studying matters and all options are open. Jacobian, the analyst, said she didn't see the situation in Lebanon changing anytime soon, barring a breakthrough in behind-the-scenes negotiations brokered by the U.S. With the Gaza ceasefire, she said, the difference could be the significant role of fellow mediators Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 21st issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.